The journey to COP26 in Glasgow has begun, and we'll be keeping you up to date every step of the way. Welcome to The Road to Glasgow. I'm Stephen Shale, External Relations Director at OGTC, and this week I'm joined by Luca Corradi, who's Innovation Network Director at OGTC, and our special guest is Karen Turner, Professor and Director of the Centre for Energy Policy at University of Strathclyde. Good morning, everyone. Let's do a wee introduction to yourself, Karen. Tell us a little bit about the Centre and how you came to lead it.
The real motivation for having the Centre for Energy Policy was to build out from the technical expertise that we've got at Strathclyde on a range of, you know, kind of energy and policy issues and energy areas. But I think that the thinking was maybe at first partly academic, you really need to work out how you're going to draw in the expertise from a wide range of social scientists. So not just economists, but, you know, kind of sociologists, political scientists and other people in those areas of expertise. And as an academic challenge, how do you actually, rather than just making these add-on to technical projects, how do you fully integrate the social science understanding? But I think it was also in terms of how we look out in the non-academic world, it was really to find how do we reach out with all the research and expertise we're bringing to these challenges? How do we reach out and interact both for the policy community, but also the wider policy stakeholder community? Because I find, for example, if I'm talking to people in industry, I'm not talking to the technical experts. I'm talking to the energy policy experts and the finance people and things like that in industry. And so it was trying to really weave this wider fabric that you need to have to answer these questions effectively. And for so the idea of the Centre for Energy Policy was really, it was part initially of a venture called the International Public Policy Institute. And now that public policy is in the title of that again there. So that's how it started up. You know, why was I attracted to it? I was at Strathclyde for a number of years before I did my PhD work at Strathclyde, and I had my first academic appointment in the economics department. And then I went off to work in other institutions. And I think just because I'd done my research largely looking at energy and climate issues, but doing it very much from this wider economy and public policy perspective, that's why, you know, that there was an outreach to me to come back, partly because I knew Strathclyde, so you knew how to start weaving all these threads together. But I think just because I had this expertise of looking at a lot of these challenges from a different perspective, how many other people were doing valuable work at Strathclyde, but there was a gap.
And the interaction between the Centre and Scottish Government, for example, is that a strong relationship? Do you find yourself doing lots of work related to their policy generation?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I've interacted with the Scottish Government all through my career, you know, because I think it's you know, they are the government who are closest by you. And that has continued through the development of the Centre. But I think partly because so much of the energy and climate domain and industry policy are actually reserved at UK level, I would say that, you know, we've had as much, if not more, interaction sometimes with the down in Westminster. It's not a separate thing because, you know, we'll often be talking to them about issues where the Scottish Government is becoming involved as part of the wider UK decision-making process. So I think it's very integrated, but just the nature of a lot of the challenges, it's really important that I think Centre for Energy Policy, it's a UK and hopefully ultimately an international research institute that happens to be based in Scotland rather than us being a Scottish centre.
I'd like to bring Luca into the conversation. Hi, Luca.
Hi, Stephen.
Yeah, I know Luca, Karen. Luca is very within OGTC centred on issues relating to policy and technology and the intersection between the two. And I know you've got a whole bunch of questions that you want to start to kind of explore, Luca. So I'll hand over to you to kind of like get some of those issues on the table.
Thank you. I think maybe a good starting point is you know, could help understand how decisions are made and policies are made. You know, you mentioned, Karen, the regional element, the national element, and of course we are going to COP26 this year, which is an international global element where policy needs to be aligned, because you know, you cannot do a regional policy without considering the national one. Yeah. and do a national policy, especially on decarbonization and carbon tax and all of that, without considering the border element, is difficult. And this year, if I remember from a slide on the Committee on Climate Change presentation, the Six Carbon Budget, we are likely to have something like, I don't know the number, but 60 or 70 policies coming out in 2021, possibly before COP21, from the net zero strategy, the heat and building strategy, the England tree strategy, and you name it. So there's a lot of work done. As is the decision then, or the influence in making a policy, what does it prioritize? Does it prioritize the local economy? Does it prioritize the overall system? What are the key elements that goes into a decision that is made in Westminster or for the devolved matters in Holyrood about an energy policy?
I think it's a complex challenge, isn't it? Because I think there's always going to be, you know, if there's multiple objectives, ideally, you know, policymakers are trying to service them all, but you're really going to get conflicts and competing interests across policies. And I think, you know, one of the really big challenges you've got with net zero and mid-century, you've got long-term outcomes to take action on now, while you've got lots of other things going on. And I think, you know, I think I've been very encouraged over the last year or so. You know, we've had this terrible situation going on with COVID, but what it has done is really turn minds, especially with us having the COP, hosting the COP this year, is how do you make one goal service another? So all the kind of, I mean, I know it's policy jargon, but the building back better and the building back greener, whatever you think of the language there, what you're seeing is a real attempt to say, we know we've to do all of these things, and how do we make them service each other? And how do you make the argument? You know, we've seen this year how, you know, some very big things have had to be financed on an emergency basis. And I think, you know, we've seen some real innovative policy thinking. You know, when you look at furlough scheme and think, I mean, that's really innovative and it's risky and it's daring. And you're not saying that those things would be replicated. I think it has started to expand minds about when we have big challenges to do, especially when it's involving huge changes in people's lives, how can you be more innovative in developing policy? And I think that's going to be an important thing for the UK to demonstrate its leadership at the COP, because they have shown that they're not always going to be able to do those things. Then when it comes down to regional level, you know, we've got this other agenda that the UK government have had about the kind of levelling up. So how much do you bring the levelling up? And I think, you know, it's another area where economic and environmental climate policy cross over, because we're talking about the big regional manufacturing clusters and how we need to decarbonize them. Now, if you decarbonize them in a way that you disadvantage a region, you're damaging your levelling up agenda. So it would seem that's another, they've got to, because these outcomes do in principle align with each other. You know, building back better and having a net zero economy, that should be better for everybody. It should be, but how do they do it? And that's the big challenge. How do you manage all of these different conflicts? And how do you keep an eye, especially in a very, very political world, how do you keep an eye and making sure that the different devolved regions and nations of the UK getting what they want out of it? So it's very, very complex, but I'm encouraged. I think there's huge potential, because we've seen how innovative policy can be when it gets a push.
I was about to ask, because I feel quite optimistic, you know, and maybe I'm too optimistic, which concerns me sometimes, but you know, there are two elements that you touch upon. One is the narrative, you know, and yes, the change in narrative. Yes. So green back better, grow back better, or grow back green, is a positive narrative, as opposed of reduce, sacrifice, carbon emissions. It's the same thing. The importance of words is high, and you mentioned the social scientists or behavioral economics into this is an important thing. The other thing that makes me optimistic, though, is that I've seen a research recently about the public sentiment about climate change and the importance of doing something about climate change is still high, you know.
And particularly high in the UK.
Particularly high in the UK, despite the COVID-19. You know, in 2008, it was high. Or it was high before 2008. And then the economic crisis push it down in the backyard because, you know, me first and my survival comes first. It seems to be more rooted now.
Yeah.
And then the further cause for optimism I have is, and maybe I'd like to hear what you think about it, you know, but the CCC report, the Six Carbon Budget that came out just before Christmas, you know, the balanced pathway there say that it is a cost saving by 2050. So what they're saying, if I translate it right, is that we need to act now and invest a lot now. And the question comes, who pays for that? You know, but if we do so by the mid-30s, then that reduction of investment will happen. And by 2050 overall, we have spent less than not doing anything. That's an interesting point, because instead of talking about the cost of decarbonization, it brings the cost of not doing it, which will be higher by 2050. Mm-hmm. So that sounds good to me, but I'd like to hear what you think about that.
I think there is an element of narrative to that, because I think, you know, one of the difficult, you know, Treasury is doing their own net zero review, and, you know, one of their conclusions was, which I would agree with, relative to where we are now, do we think the kind of green route is going to give us a huge boost or it's going to cost us? And I kind of think all depends very much on how you do it. There are opportunities to do things well and create wider economy gains so that you put yourself in a position. But at the same time, we have to accept that there are some things that we're going to have to do that are going to have net costs, either in their own right or the manner of paying for them. We need to be more concerned about the distributional implications, you know, to ensure that, you know, you don't want to make, when we're building back better, it has to be better for everybody. You, the people who are least able to pay get ground down further. So, and resolving some of those issues, we might end up bearing extra costs, so that it's not quite true that we absolutely reduce the cost relative to where we might otherwise be in 2030. But that's not necessarily a bad thing if you're doing it the right way for the long term and for how people want to live and how they want to see their society develop. And so I do wonder if a little bit, it's not clear sometimes when people are doing longer term scenarios. And I mean, I'm an economy-wide modeler, but I don't like to do too much projective work, because, you know, there's so many things that come into play to determine an outcome. I don't think we can say for sure that that is true, that we'll be at a lower cost, but I don't think that's necessarily the priority. You know, there are some things that we should bear costs for. We just need to be careful who bears them and what outcome we end up with, because at the end of the day, if you can retain a prosperous, growing economy, you can recover a lot of what you've had to pay out, even if the costs were higher.
And you touch upon the redistribution point, which is very important, right? Because Scotland is on one hand very rich in natural resources from wind and tidal and in the hydro.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it is a high number of people living in energy poverty. Yes. That has been a sort of a conundrum or a, you know, contradiction for some time. And I think, you know, if we build back greener and build back better, better also has to solve that challenge, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, that this is one of the challenges that, you know, that there's a lot of discussion around now about, you know, what's the right business model for different things. In a lot of cases, we don't have a business model. Yeah. You know, we have what happens, and I suppose it is the current business model, is that things have to get done and then the costs get passed on through energy bills. Which means, you know, that in the way that that is spread, it means that costs of heating homes become higher. You know, in Scotland, yes, we've got an energy poverty problem, but we've got a wider poverty problem in Scotland. Energy poverty is one part of that. And I think to be very careful, you know, first of all, the approach of simply passing costs on through energy bills, I think that's coming close to it in terms of how much we can do from that. There's challenges around other approaches, but just in terms of poverty element, you know, things like if we find other ways of doing things, and for example, products just need to be more expensive, well, that's going to drive a wider kind of poverty. And you could end up talking about carbon poverty. You know, if carbon taxes are putting up costs of things. You know, one that that I think people haven't really managed to hook onto in the same way as they have some other things is, you know, when petrochemicals and chemicals industries and things like that, and then you go and look in your bathroom and all the things that you depend on, like your deodorants and your shampoos and things, if they were more expensive. You know, we talk a lot about transport poverty, period poverty and things like that. You know, you would hate to see the climate debate starting to be characterized by something called carbon poverty? Because as you say, mm-hmm. we've moved out of the space where it's economy versus environment and you can build back better. But some of these distributional consequences, you don't manage this right, you could really accentuate them. It's not just energy poverty that we've noticed. I think that's a real concern, you know, and it's reflected in the objectives of the Treasury review. It's not all just about overall GDP growth and employment. We really need to think about who pays how and when and what the distributional implications are. And for me, that's almost one of the primary concerns, because you can always find ways to grow the wider economy and attract foreign direct investment and things. Increasing GDP is a much easier job than reducing inequalities.
I love that you talk about GDP, because, you know, that's very hot topic, right? So just I think early this week or last week, the report from the University of Cambridge came out about how do we incorporate nature in the price. And I think the debate about GDP being focused on growth and being the only measure and being not so appropriate anymore to sustain, to, you know, to drive a sustainable economy, is gaining traction. You know, the book about donut economics by Kate Raworth a couple of years ago, but also, you know, the First Minister in Scotland gave a TED talk about the need to move away from GDP. So is that going to happen? You know, do you think that is going to be maybe a topic for a discussion at COP26? Because the other thing that comes to my mind is, you know, I think I read by 2065 or thereabout, the global population will start stalling, you know, and stop growing.
Yeah.
And population growth is one of the main reasons why GDP works.
Well, I mean, I think I kind of almost, in a lot of ways, I kind of wonder what, I'm not sure that people have got the question right here, because I think, you know, there's a few things about GDP. You know, first of all, it's a statistic and it shouldn't be used in isolation. Second of all, it's a useful statistic. GDPs can be measured in several ways, which all have to balance against each other. And, you know, and I think one of the benefits that we've got is that countries all around the world measure it in the same way. And that international comparability is very, very important. And that's been a real problem for many other statistics coming through. But there's two main components if you measure GDP by the income measure. And one of them is income from employment, which is just incredibly important for people. So I think, you know, when we talk about what use is GDP, it remains a very important statistic. It tells us how much income we're generating in our economy. And so that's one of the primary reasons why you have an economy. And statisticians can break it down in terms of who that income flows to. You can move to gross national income, which is where we correct for the fact that some of the income generated here will go to other countries and income generated in other countries will come here. So I think, aside from the fact that we've got international agreements on how to measure GDP, it is a very useful measure. It just doesn't tell the whole story. So I don't think it's a case that we want to move away from it. I think we want to think, what else do we need to be reporting alongside GDP? And I know, you know, certainly when I report, whenever I run economy-wide models, one of the metrics I always get out of it is GDP. I have not yet met a public policymaker who only wants to hear about GDP. They always want to hear about other things. They always want to know about what kind of metrics we can get to sit alongside GDP in the decision-making process. So I think we need to keep it. I think we know how to measure it. It's very important. It measures something that we need to know. It just doesn't measure everything that we need to know. And then we get into the challenge of, you know, I did some work early in my career looking at other measures that could sit alongside GDP. And there was one of them called an Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, which sounds exactly what we need. But the problem with it was when we did applied work, you know, it might be going up in a trajectory like that. We went in and changed one assumption and it would go down like that. So we've got a problem in measuring it depending on what our assumptions are. But what about all the other countries in the world? Are they going to make the same? So I think absolutely GDP should not be telling the whole story. I don't think it does now. And we need to think carefully about what the policy objectives are and the societal objectives are going forward. What metrics do we need to sit alongside GDP? I don't think it should be GDP or not. I think it plays its role, but we really need to think about, if we've got all these objectives and targets and concerns, what statistics should we be building to report robustly and transparently so that we can track that progress?
And I guess that applies at macro, and it applies at microeconomic as well. There's another tendency now, which is, okay, talking about people, profit and planet, not just profit. And again, very recently, the CEO of BlackRock, which is one of the biggest investors, sent a letter to the CEOs threatening action if they don't include seriously sustainability measures in their program. I think there's still the challenge of how to measure these things and how to report and how to really incorporate that, you know, moving not away, but adding, as you said, to the maximum return for the shareholders, which has been the mantra since the 80s, you know, something else that includes the people on the planet into it.
And I do, you know, because what you want to be doing is, you know, when we do our work, you know, we track all the different indicators, and, you know, the best outcome is that they all move in the same direction. You know, because then that means that you are getting to meet your multiple objectives. Where it gets more challenging, as it often does, is when, you know, one indicator that you want to work goes in one direction and another one goes in another. And in trying to, for policy to intervene and make the one that's not doing so well perform better, do you do it in a way that damages the one that was already performing well? So, but that's what we need. We need to have metrics that, for any action we plan to take, we can say, what will this action do to that metric, and where we have a problem, how can we go about resolving it in a way that we keep the gains that we had in something else?
So do you think this could be or should be a topic at the COP26 coming to Glasgow in November? So what we expect from Glasgow is a check and a renewal or an update of the pledges made in Paris in 2015, and countries coming to the fore with their renewed pledge and commitment.
I think the first priority for the COP really needs to be to identify what the challenging issues are. And I think, you know, I mean, again, you know, another statistical, you know, it relates to a statistical problem that we've had over the years. You know, we measure our territorial emissions, and that's all our international agreements are based on, but they're the emissions we generate here. And a lot of people have said, why do we not account for our carbon our consumption carbon footprint? And, you know, one answer to that is it's incredibly difficult to count your carbon footprint. But the other thing is, you know, that you've had decades now of getting countries to agree based on the territorial emissions, and now they are agreeing, and that's great news. But the challenge is, way of reducing the emissions in your economy is just to stop doing the dirty stuff and import it from somewhere else. That doesn't help global emissions at all. So I think, and there is a real challenge, you know, that when, you know, we're all pressing the UK government and the devolved governments in the UK to be leaders and to move first, for example, industrial decarbonisation, and impose a costly solution on the operators who are working here, they're going to lose competitiveness, and then you start to get offshoring pressures happening, and things will shift overseas. And so, you know, there is a real challenge there about, if the other countries don't follow, or we don't have some kind of, you know, kind of, you know, people have talked a lot about border tax adjustments. If we don't have some way of allowing our industries to become climate competitive, that they are doing things that will allow them to retain competitiveness, that's going to be a real challenge. And I think, especially when you're in an international environment, you need to talk about these issues, sort out what the issues are and what people might be willing to work on. And then I think the need for metrics will flow from that, because you'll have worked out and hopefully agreed on what the challenges are and how you're going to monitor progress in addressing those challenges. And, you know, just to throw in, I'll say up front, I'm not going to claim to have read 1,200 pages, but the silver lining of the Brexit agreement was, it's the first bilateral trade agreement that has actually had a commitment that both sides need to meet their domestic emissions targets. That's really important, because that's one of the things that we hope it never falls apart, but that's one of the things that the Brexit agreement could fall on if the other side increases emissions. And, you know, if we have all these complications with retaining competitiveness and, you know, complications of what kind of policy instruments you could have, one of the simplest ways is to agree when you do bilateral trade agreements, you're not going to let your emissions rise because you're going to damage our competitiveness as we try to be greener. So I think the challenge of doing this and keeping companies who are operating in countries who are trying to do the right thing over climate to ensure that that doesn't damage competitiveness and that all our trade rules and things like that don't penalise countries who are trying to do the right thing and decarbonising. I think if we start to have those kinds of discussions, the metrics will flow from that.
It's interesting because, you know, the carbon border tax basically is a way to prevent import of higher carbon intensive equivalent of the low carbon domestic product. But at the same time, it doesn't help the product being produced in a country be competitive outside unless you subsidize it or you take out that, you know, that's the complication thing. It works one way better than it works the other way.
Yeah. Yes, you know, so they are, it's the kind of, you know, the kind of on paper, if I had some of my theoretical colleagues and you know, kind of trade economics, they would probably be able to work out a very nice equation for how a border tax would work. But in practice, I think we absolutely should be exploring the different instruments. But I think I would love to see different nations sitting down at the COP and identifying and agreeing on the challenge and thinking, you know, what are some really efficient ways that we can work things out? Because at the end of the day, I mean, like most economists, I recognize the need for tax levers and things like that, but I know they're distortive. So I like to minimize their use.
Yeah, also because, you know, tax is one of the way that policy are made. So back to the original question about how policy works. Policy normally from government works either you put a price on it and tax something, and therefore try to influence the direction of travel of the economy with that, or something is just regulated. So you cannot produce without emissions, full stop, it doesn't matter how much you pay. Or you create a market. You can, and you trade. You know, that's the trade emission target or emission trading, etc. So there are three different ways in which government can influence or direct or create policies. And when it comes to COP, we got all the world, and all the world is made of many different government systems. And so maybe there's a different mix in each country or in each region. Because you know, market mechanisms don't really work in a non-market economy.
And so, you know, so I think it's, and you know, there also is a thing, you know, with policy, it can always be so much efficient and quicker acting if we can look at all the things we've already got and how we can adjust and tinker with them. I think it's sometimes when you try to come up with new things that you get a lot of resistance and a lot of lack of understanding, a lot of investigation. So required in order to design things the right way and in a way that they will work. And, you know, working within WTO rules and state aid rules and things like that you're, you know, because in principle, when you're trying to decarbonize, you're trying to create a market failure. You're not trying to distort a market. In practice, it's a little bit more complicated than that and depends a lot on the perceptions. But yeah, I mean, that's my main wish for the COP is that some of these cross-border issues is actually to be sitting down and agreeing the challenge and, you know, kind of what the ideal solutions are there.
Back to the optimism, I think there are some interesting signs, right? So the Biden administration rejoining or stopping the exit from the Paris Agreement. Yeah. One of the first action has been the stop of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is mostly symbolic rather than material, but it is probably sending a message. And the second interesting was, you know, the declaration that all the federal vehicles, or 650,000 vehicles of federal, will have to be U.S.-made electric vehicles. So that seems to be going strongly in one direction. So do we expect to see U.S. Really back to the table and really driving? Because, you know, we have probably for the first time so far in the history of the COP, China making a stronger move, you know, it's 2060 instead of 2050, yeah. Not a year, but, you know, it's China is big. Yeah. You know, neutral by 2060, China is a big thing. And China just last year added 71.7 gigawatt of wind, which is what we are trying to do by 2050 in the UK. They did it in 1 year. And, and on top of that, they added 48 gigawatt of solar, you know, just to show the size of the movement. So you have China is moving that direction. The US seems to be joining back and driving. The EU has always been the champion of low carbon. Those are those big three blocks are the kind of the keystone actor that can really drive a global change. Yeah. That's my hope. What's your hope?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, I think the US situation has really been interesting because even when the previous administration was withdrawing the United States from the climate agreement, you know, some of the states in the United States are huge economies, and they made very clear that they were still going in the Paris direction. So, but I think there is no mistaking, there is a huge symbolic thing about the United States as a country coming back in. And I think, and it's not only symbolic, it is practical, because as you say, it means that for the first COP ever, you're less worried about the entire negotiation being about picking. You know, at one point, apparently, there was an argument to use the word should or the word shall, because should is a kind of ambition if we possibly can. Shall is much more definitive. And, you know, there has been arguments over that type of language in the past. And all the days of the call, if it gets taken up with that, you don't end up with much coming out. So I am very optimistic that this time you actually have countries wanting to come to talk from the first instance. And that's why I would love to see them getting challenged with the more challenging thing of competitiveness and international trade, because I think it's in a way easier, it's a relative term, all the good things that you're doing at home to reduce your emissions. And of course we need to have these things, but you don't really need an international, you know, kind of consultation down together to talk about it. It's what do you really need people sitting down talking about? And, you know, and things like that element of the Brexit agreement, that I would love to see what went on in the room there. You're thinking, you know, where was it, two countries were genuinely committed to that, or was it some very pro-climate negotiators on both sides says we've got an opportunity to get this in? At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, it's in there, you know. And I think to start seeing moves like that, where even if, you know, kind of the conversations, will these things work better and have more power if we all do it bilaterally, or you know, the problem with multilateral agreements, you know, you're moving into a world where there's much more concern over sovereignty and things like that. That means that you can make international agreements, but you might not actually be able to enforce them. So I think you need to talk about the solutions and how you're going to enforce or ensure that the different countries keep to the solutions. So I think that's a real challenge that it would be good to see COP really starting to address.
So you're bringing me down to earth now from my exaggerated optimism.
I'll take you back up again. I mean, as I said, I've been very enthused. I think, you know, COVID, you know, if we could all wind back the clock, we wouldn't have COVID happening. But now that it has happened, we have seen some real innovations in policy. And I think with the UK hosting the COP, where there have been some real policy innovations, you know, kind of when you're dealing with difficult transitory situations, I think that's the other thing that needs to be done. It's not just the international kind of interaction that I think is so important. It's actually saying, what kind of policy leadership do we need here? What can we learn from different countries who have made bold steps? And whether it's in the climate domain or other domains, but, you know, we need it. These are public policy challenges, and we need real innovation in how public policy is done.
And Scotland has an opportunity, you know, being Glasgow, being the centre of this one. And I think what I would love to see is, you know, Scotland taking that opportunity and especially driving on the front of technology innovation. You know, you wouldn't be surprised of that coming from OGTC, but because there are two narratives probably to the solution. You know, one is doing more and one is doing less. You know, we can eat less meat, we can travel less, so we can reduce, change our behavior so we reduce the impact, and we should do that.
Yeah.
The other one is we should do more innovation, more technology.
Yeah.
More, you know, more hydrogen, low cost, find new ways of doing things that somehow maintain society and life closer to what we experience today. You know, so that's I think different audiences prefer different narratives, but
yeah,
a combination of two, isn't it?
Because ideally you want to bring them both together, because I think, you know, when you look at things like, you know, I mean, again, I'm an economist, so we love anything that improves efficiency. Either doing more with less, you know, so that you aim to do more to kind of increase prosperity and reduce inequality. How can you do more while you do less of the damaging things? And I think, you know, there has been a lot of discussion, you know, from lockdown and things like that about, you know, will people travel less and things? I think the answer is a mixed one. I never realized how much I would miss commuting because of the headspace that it gave me. The more I used to think I hated my train journey, and now I think I might have, my husband says I might have a bit of a romantic idea that I'm imagining myself in a 1930s Agatha Christie movie in the train, and it wasn't actually like that. People are going to want to go out and about more, but I think, you know, certainly like business, look how we've learned to do stuff online. You used to have no choice but to go to a conference or to go down to London for a meeting and things like that. So I think we can learn to change a lot of things. And, you know, and like for me, like you, look, I've had to change my diet for medical reasons. I found out I can eat completely differently to how I did before and still be. And so I think the major changes through the COVID thing, I think you're right. People have had a lot of time to think and probably a more philosophical way than they ever thought that they could. So it's a time to grab onto that. I think probably the public's minds are more open. They know what their reference is. They know they need a job. They need an ability to earn an income. They need security in that job and that income. But they might be flexible if you can assure them that they've got that. You know, I think before we used to frighten people that, you know, your sector might close and you might lose your job to do this. It was kind of winners and losers. I think if we can get away from that winners and losers language to work out, you know, solutions that you are securing for people what they want, then their minds, or what they want and what they need, then their minds will be more open to changing things.
Fascinating discussion. I've been
very philosophical.
Absolutely. I've been sitting here in the sidelines listening to Luca and yourself, Karen, really exchange a lot of quite complex arguments and ideas, and it's been great to listen to. We're coming to the end of our time together, and I'm going to try to bring both of you back down to a very sort of earthy level. So if I'm sitting in the south side of Glasgow, in, I don't know, Darnley or Knits Hill or Ardenne or someplace like that, what can I reasonably expect to gain from the COP coming to Glasgow? Because I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking themselves. What does it mean to me?
People might have quite a lot of worry, you know, because there's a lot of talk about the answers being things like more electrification of heat. Look how they've done it in other countries. But for people living in this country, especially in low incomes, electricity in the UK is high cost. When people need to change their boiler, if they buy it themselves, a renewable heat pump is much more expensive. We have heard stories in some of the lower income areas of Glasgow where landlords or housing associations have brought in new heating systems, and it's ended up costing people a lot more. So I could imagine that people in those areas would be nervous if a great amount of steam gets behind things that are going to cost them more. The challenge then is not that you go off that path. What policy solutions do you need to do to allay these people's fears? Because ultimately, they're not afraid of an electric heating system. They're afraid of what it's going to cost them. So what can you do to redistribute income or to make this affordable for them if it's going to be the way forward? And, you know, similarly with things like electric vehicles, a lot of people will be sitting and say, well, I can't afford to buy a new diesel car, never mind a new electric car. this isn't even relevant to me, but with all the upgrades to the system, I'm going to pay for that through my energy bill. So I think what it does bring back to is then, does COP really needs to talk about the who pays how and when, and how you compensate people if you're asking them to follow a path that the market will make too expensive for them. So I think we're adding to the COP agenda all the time. I want to see them talking about international things. I want to see them talking about policy innovation. And I think maybe linking to that, policy innovations are relevant. I think they probably do need to talk a lot about equality. Yeah. But actually at the COP, a lot of the equality issues are geopolitical. You know, there's people who live in Africa are a lot worse off than, you know, kind of maybe even the poorest people here. So that might not be the place you'll talk about inequality within our nation. That's probably a debate for us to have at home. I think that recognition always needs to be that we're coming up with these big solutions. Can we do them in a way that's going to work? And at the end of the day, if we don't do it in a way that works for people, they won't vote for the government to brought it in. You know, we've seen what happens when there's a popular vote, popular electoral turn against the way things are. People have maybe never voted before, but feel so strongly about something. So even if you don't particularly care about people, you care about politics. And, you know, the world of politics can disrupt things if we don't take people along with it.
Super. And I think on that note, it's probably as good a place as any to draw the conversation to a conclusion. But it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much, Karen Turner.
Thank you for having me, yeah.
And Luca. And look forward to hopefully seeing you in Glasgow in November. It's an exciting time in our industry, so please take it all in, get involved. So listen, subscribe, and if you have any questions, get in touch with us via our website at ogtc.com. You can also follow us on our social media channels, LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, for all the latest updates.